Hello again, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast, presented by NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As humanity confronts the reality of sustaining 10 billion people on a single planet, the intersection of artificial intelligence, biotechnology, and natural systems offers unprecedented opportunities for innovation. Our food system today consumes over 1.0 times the Earth GDP annually, a trajectory that threatens both human and planetary health in the Anthropocene era. Today, we're going to explore how AI can unlock nature's molecular library to solve humanity's most significant human and planetary health and sustainability challenges. We'll examine how systems nutrition approaches can replace reductionist thinking, why traditional food development methods are failing to meet global needs, and how convergent technologies are enabling us to mine the biochemical richness of plants at unprecedented scale and speed. I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO of Shoshimworks, and I'm joined today by our guest, Dr. Martin Kussmann, head of science at Bavaria's Confidence Center for Nutrition and founder and CEO of Kussmann Biotech GmbH. So Martin, welcome. Thrilled to have you join us today. And let's start with your unique perspective on leveraging AI intelligence to navigate what you call nature's reservoir of molecular solutions. And before we dive into that, if you could just share a little bit more about your background with our listeners so they can understand your background and your portfolio of work.
Thank you very much, Diane, for this wonderful introduction. And thanks so much also for having me. I was quite surprised, actually, to be contacted by or in the name of NASA, because I'm neither an astronaut nor a space traveler or astrophysicist. But let's see what I can contribute here to the systems thinking that you're looking for. My background is biochemistry. I have a PhD in biochemistry and especially analytical biochemistry and genomics. And I have led a vagabond life in different countries, also outside Europe. New Zealand is the farthest that I can offer. And I was basically researching in biotechnology and human nutrition and health. And I did this in academic settings. I was associate or full professor at Aarhus University in Denmark, at the Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne in Switzerland, and also at the University of Auckland at the Liggett Institute in New Zealand. I know big food players like Nestle. I've been many years with Nestle in various research functions. And I also know startups and smaller companies, SMEs. And I also have experience with government work. I have never been a politician, but I worked for governments. And that was in New Zealand for a national science program, which I scientifically led. That was about food innovation. And now in my role at this Competence Center for Nutrition, I work for the Bavarian government to improve the Bavarian food system.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, the future of aerospace and humanity's really next chapter in space is very much about the human systems and the systems that support humanity, right? Human factors is a massive part of kind of what will enable the journey into the space economy. So much of the work that you have led will help us pave that pathway into the space economy and kind of evolve how we not only leverage and protect what we have here on Earth, but unlock what lies ahead in the space economy. So really excited to jump into this conversation. I just think there are so many fascinating parallels in your work and the work that NASA is doing. It just specifically some of the societal opportunities, Martin, you've described the challenge of feeding 10 billion people sustainably is requiring us to find a methodology to tap into nature's reservoir of molecular solutions. We're essentially conducting space exploration at a molecular level, which is, I think, just such a fascinating perspective. How does this systems level thinking fundamentally change our approach to solving wicked problems that effectively transcend traditional organizational and really research boundaries?
Yeah, I think, Diane, what we probably both have in common is the recognition or acknowledgement of systems thinking being necessary to advance. And if you want to explore nature's reservoir of bioactives, which basically means that nature arguably has molecular answers to pretty much everything we can ask about human health and sustainability, then, of course, the question is, how do we find these answers? They are existing, but it's difficult to find. It's a little bit like you have an enormous library, but you don't know where the book is or where the sentence stands that you're looking for. And evolution had all the time to develop these solutions, and we don't. So we need to leverage AI, and we are doing this in the sense that exploring or extrapolating from the known space of natural products and bioactives, we can try to predict what else is there. That is one thing. And the other approach is by simply knowing already quite a number of biomolecules, and we know millions of them, we can gather all the properties that they have as far as they are known, and then we can come up with predictive tools that may give us an answer to find a molecule for a specific benefit. For example, rather than going out into nature, grind it all up, try to fractionate it, to separate it, to analyze it, to find activities, which is basically the approach of the brute force approach of high throughput screening, you would first say, so what is the solution I need and for what problem I need to solve? For example, let's take the example of physical mobility or muscular health. Then you can say, okay, what are the problems in muscular health? It's muscle atrophy, so you lose muscle mass, you don't recover after injury, or you don't recover so fast after exercise and all these things. And then you can ask the system, so your knowledge system, which is largely AI driven and experimentally data fed, can you provide a molecular solution to address this? And then this system comes up with a finite number of candidates that you can then test, and you can refine the search in the sense that there's no negative answer. Also, the negative results feed back into the system. So the brain always learns from each and every experience. And you simply can reduce the number of experiments and the effort, the experimental effort. You can compress it to such a small time because your initial selection of based on prediction is so good. And I think in space research, it's similar. I mean, we know already a lot about space, but it's probably more that we don't know. So you also need to extrapolate and try to make predictions. What else could be out there given based on what we currently see?
Yeah, the toolkit is incredibly, it basically just amplifies our ability to study what has been and extrapolate to your point and potentially simulate the possibilities. Vastly accelerating kind of the scientific process, the research process. If we kind of continue to pull that thread through your work at NEMA Life's AI-powered discovery platform, you're doing a lot of work to accelerate the bioactive discovery process, literally from years to weeks. For complex mission systems, to your point, how can basically similar AI biological hybrid platforms transform our approach to life support and resource utilization in extreme environments? We're seeing a lot of amazing work done with our space research colleagues in microgravity, as an example. How do these tools and approaches help them accelerate the work that they're leading?
Well, let's start with the NEMA Life platform, and then I can maybe also tell you something about another biotech I'm consulting, which is also in the bioactive field. AI can predict, but in the end, the proof of the pudding lies in testing, right? So you have to test at some point. And in the end, you have to test in humans. So what we do at NEMA Life is we design smart experiments to avoid unnecessary testing based on predictive tools we have. And then we have a mini organism that is very well studied. It's C. elegans. It's the worm that has been studied and even has been involved in various Nobel Prizes. So it's probably one of the best characterized organisms we have. It's very tiny, and it's, from a regulatory perspective, not considered an animal. So basically, you test in vivo, but you don't do animal testing. So that is a very, very important point. And you can do this in because of the size. And then we have microfluidics and we do AI-based phenotypic readouts. So you can observe these animals, how they react and which behaviors they show. So you can basically test a battery of bioactive against a series of benefits, okay, in vivo, live. You can observe it and capture it, and then you have the data. So that is enormously accelerating and facilitating the traditional approach of in vitro testing, so no living systems, it's cells or even molecules. Animal testing, which is very much under scrutiny for various good reasons also. And then you go to humans. So you pick good candidates, go straight in vivo, and because all the biology that is in the worm can also be found in humans, of course, the worms are much more primitive, as obvious.
Yep.
But as evolution doesn't reinvent the wheel, it basically expands, right? Evolution is an expansion process. It doesn't reinvent the wheel. So everything that has been invented for the worm, we also have in humans. So there is relevance, okay? And then we can also go it the other way around when we say, okay, sustainability is a big deal in discovery. And so it is, I think, in space research. And I consult another company in Barcelona, in Spain, called Green Biopeptides. And this company has access to bioactive peptide cocktails from plants and foods that can be sustainably sourced. Now, peptides, the cool thing about peptides is, these are the words of biology, okay? Because typically when people think about nutrients, they think about replenishing reservoirs, filling up stuff that may be lacking. Now, this is a different thing. So we use peptides to speak to the body to do the right thing. So we teach the body to recover, to heal, and not fall sick. So that is also a very smart design approach, using the words, and these are peptides of biology. Now, in terms of analogy to your closed system, sustained life systems, I think it's even an advantage to work in the closed system because it's closed, right? I mean, we when we test in humans or in living systems, usually it's at least a leaky system. It's not closed.
Sure.
It has always an open environment. And you predefine, I think, in space research and when you design these mission spaces, you design the environment in a very precise manner. So your environment is more defined, it's confined, and it's better defined. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's an advantage. And that makes, I think, in a similar way, testing, predictive testing and iterative testing more powerful than if you were in an open system, like a society or a large cohort or whatever. So I think there's a lot of analogy. You also mentioned microgravity. That was a point that I had been going through a bit later in my thoughts about our interview. That is a very good example because we talked already about physical mobility, right? And muscular health. This is the reason why I brought it up. Because zero gravity is such a big challenge for space travel because we know it causes atrophy. So if you can do predictive testing and smart experiment design, you can avoid a lot of that collateral damage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we're getting more and more opportunities to test different applications, different scenarios in that environment. So that's preparing the way, of course. And maybe kind of, again, continuing that thread a little bit more, your research shows us that traditional explicit methods of food development oftentimes miss the vast complexity of natural bioactives, much like how traditional data collection methods often miss implicit behavioral drivers. We've covered that in some recent episodes, recent discussions. You're essentially creating technologies that can see and quantify biological effects that were previously invisible, really kind of enriching the investigation, if you will. What are some of the parallels that you see between this biological intelligence and the hidden system dynamics that we need to understand for space exploration and just for society more broadly?
Well, let's compare maybe the tools that we use to decipher or to characterize the biomolecular universe with your telescopes, right? I mean, you have telescopes that look into the sky, which is a very, of course, traditional word for all the cosmos that's out there. And as the resolution has increased and you can cover different spectra and so you see so much more. It's the same with these instruments we use. They're called mass spectrometers. That's one of my favorites because I spent my PhD thesis on it. And it started basically on the genomic philosophy or genomic revolution. I remember the Human Genome Project in the 2000s, big consortia and a private company. I actually met Craig Venter once personally. What an encounter. It was very impressive.
I would imagine.
Yes. So they sequenced the average human genome, so to say. It was an average genome from different samples. And then they discovered, oh, it's only 23,000 genes, right? So it is like you look into the sky and you only can see Milky Way. You can't see any further. And you think that's it, right? And then you realize it's probably not all that we should know about complexity. There must be a different dimension, maybe several Milky Way, several galaxies. And that is the analogy to the proteome on top of the genome, to the transcriptome, you know, the transcribed genes, the proteins, the metabolites, and so on and so on. So basically, it's the whole molecular, biomolecular universe that we can now analyze. And that was made possible by a technique which is different from classical sequencing. So it was much more difficult to do this than genome sequencing, because in the genome there are only four letters, in proteins there are 20 letters. That already makes it very complex. So mass spec could do this. So take it this as, you know, an analogy to your super telescopes that can look beyond our galaxy.
Right.
And so what we did then is, and you know, I'm just one of very many that had the privilege to witness this era, which started in the 90s, early 90s. So we basically started measuring pretty much everything under the sun, right? Because it was so exciting, right? It was so exciting. We just could do it. And that's a very typical scientific behavior. If you can do something, you are so excited about the possibility, you just go ahead. And then there was this revelation. Oh, I mean, these are very complex patterns. There's so many molecules. Does it really tell us? And if yes, what does it tell us about the behavior of the system? So it is like you can see a million times more stars, but does it improve the understanding of the cosmos, right? Same thing. And then we had to use a lot more of what we then called bioinformatics, try to link all these different pieces of information, visualization tools. And then again, we come to AI that helps us to see the forest for all the trees, right? I mean, we see so many trees, but often we don't see the forest anymore. And AI can help us in when we are confronted with enormous complexity,
right,
that we can't make sense of. We still have to validate it. And I still believe that human intelligence is unsurpassed and will probably always be unsurpassed in terms of its versatility. That's a personal remark, but I think it is truly the case. We are not champions in anything, but we can do pretty much everything. That's the advantage of humans. Whereas AI is superior in many, many, many specialized tools that we can just not handle.
Completely agree. And we're seeing that relationship evolve just right in front of us every day. And as you know, our work here is in the study of ecosystems and in complex system dynamics, right? And so it kind of how we best leverage these tools as the tools evolve is a constant opportunity and challenge, right? Teasing out with greater precision where they're helpful and where we, the humans still need to take the lead. You have identified just a few factors, a sustainable generation and the consumption of energy and food as some of the biggest challenges that we face. As we mentioned earlier, currently, human consumption surpasses Earth's capacity by consuming over one times Earth's GDP annually. So speaking of ecosystems and complex systems design, complex dynamic systems design, how should we think about designing ecosystems, whether on Earth or in space, that operate within planetary boundaries or resource constraints while meeting our needs?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this question also for quite some time. And honestly, I think on Earth, It is rather about restoring and preserving ecosystems than designing them, simply because they are so inherently resilient and beautiful. And I think we just have underappreciated this for a long time, also interpreting humans as, you know, the species that should basically control Earth and exploit it. And then we discovered, oh, resources are finite, so maybe that is not such a good idea to just continue business as usual. So on Earth, it's more understanding the ecosystems and how everything is interconnected. And it's absolutely fascinating how at a first glance, completely distant and seemingly disconnected systems still are linked to everything, interacts with everything. And appreciate this connectivity, the complexity, the diversity, and then maybe use that knowledge to learn something about possibly designing a space for living outside Earth. I'm not an astronomist, as you know. I just think with my simple biochemist mind, I would think that finding another Earth would be a very lucky punch. And if we find it, it's probably very far away. that will be my guess. Just because this, what happened on Earth, has been so unlikely. It's in an extremely unlikely case and a beautiful case. So the more we understand about Earth, I think the better we can project ourselves into space. This is how I would see it.
No doubt, no doubt. And there could be many scenarios where what we discover in space could help us to restore and preserve Earth, right? There could be minerals, nutrient sources of great kind of restorative resource that could be helpful here as well. So it's a fascinating discovery moment in the human journey, and exciting to see how we can take our learnings and our practices and reach a little bit further. I'd like to maybe switch gears just slightly, Martin, if we could, and touch on your work in precision nutrition.
Before we do that, could I just add one little thought?
Please.
I mean, one thought of great sympathy and admiration for space research is not only how to possibly think about could we live somewhere else and, you know, how does it look like? I think it's one of the most inherent drives of human curiosity is the question, where do we come from and where do we go?
Yes.
And astronomy is the best discipline to answer that, right? Because we want to go back to the Big Bang or even before and try to understand all this. So if we understand the origin, we can also be better at predicting our future. And I can fully understand that this is a very strong driver for their research, regardless of spaces elsewhere.
No doubt. No doubt. Yeah. No, it's a constant struggle to understand our origin, really who we are, our purpose, and where we go from here. And I think nothing is challenging that existential kind of exploration greater than AI at the moment. So it's an interesting moment in the human journey, as I mentioned. So I think so much of what, you know, where we find greatness is what challenges kind of who we are and what is possible. So yeah, I agree. And I'd love to maybe dig into your work in precision nutrition. We've touched on this in previous discussions in our series, have had some really great discussions. Your work specifically demonstrates how individual genetic, metabolic, and microbiome profiles actually require different nutritional approaches. And I'd love to learn a little bit more about that. If you could help our listeners understand that work, but then also, you know, following the space aerospace exploration theme, you know, as we start to consider those long duration missions with diverse crews, how can these precision approaches better inform the human factors and life support system design and crew health optimization? So once again, here on Earth and as we move forward into space, how is your work informing how we should be thinking about those systems design?
Yeah, so maybe let's start again with the genes. So we have found out that we have only 23,000 genes, so there's so much more molecular complexity to our individuality. So that's appreciation of precision nutrition. And precision nutrition also acknowledges the fact that, which is a no-brainer, that the phenotypes or the way we appear, we look, is always a product of genes X environment. So you can look at the genes as your potential, and the environment lets or doesn't let you make something of that potential. So how you leverage the potential largely depends on the environment, and your genes give you some predisposition. And precision nutrition now says one size doesn't fit all. This said, the digestive system in the body is very resilient. So, I mean, there are many fundamental rules and processes that are identical in all humans. That is very clear. But the individual makeup, including genetics, makes you be more or less susceptible to certain diets or certain lifestyles. And precision nutrition basically has two goals. First of all, preventing disease by targeted nutrition and also enhancing performance, right, for those that are interested in, and possibly also promote recovery after illness. And this is clinical nutrition where this is already being applied, you know. Think about cancer patients that suffer from cachexia and these kind of things. There are nutritional products that help you getting back on your feet, which is so important.
Right.
And I think one maybe the most beautiful example that illustrates how gene and environment can make these wonderful products is the example of human longevity, right? If you look at the blue zones over the planet,
yes,
where most long-lived people live, and long life is defined as you reach 100 years at good health. That's a big deal, right? 100 years at good health, that's quite something. And if you look where that happens, immediately you can think about Okinawa, a southern Japanese island that everybody knows, and a few areas in the Mediterranean, California, Costa Rica. These are 5-6 blue zones. So now the spontaneous question would be, oh, that's great. Now we know where the people live a long and healthy life. We just have to find out about the commonalities, and then we know the recipe for a long, healthy life. Well, it's actually the wrong question, because if you look at these five zones, they have very little in common. It's all different genes. It's all different environments,
right,
a different climate, and almost different everything. The only commonality is moderate physical activity and maybe strong societal bondings. The rest is very different. So this is what precision nutrition is all about. And again, when you go on a space mission or you plan to deposit, so to say, drop off a few humans in a foreign planet, well, you probably know ahead of time a lot about that environment, right? Because it's most likely a little simpler, because it's not an ecosystem. It's probably maybe a hostile environment. And the spaceship is confined, as we said, it's a closed system. So then you can say, okay, I know the conditions. These are the challenges. For example, microgravity and that kind of thing. I know which astronauts I will recruit. And depending on where they come from, they may have different needs. And then you can try to model these challenges into this system, and it may give you an answer of how to develop precision nutrition for your space missions. I think that would be even easier than in real life. Again, because it's a small, confined system. It's closed.
Right. Yeah, so many of them, to your point, so many of these lessons in the conversations we've been having, we've been extrapolating the systems design concepts to explore which of these frameworks and lessons we could apply to business ecosystems or market ecosystems, which are much more open and dynamic, right? It's, to your point, the design of these closed systems is more within reach for now, but as we start to extrapolate into market-based ecosystems, it becomes more challenging. But I love the parallels, and I love kind of testing the limits of these parallels. If we stay on that thread, Martin, I'd love to now kind of turn to the concept that you've pioneered of systems nutrition, where personal health data correlates with lifestyle and environmental factors to establish some directional relationships, as you've mentioned. So this may actually represent a shift from reductionist to more ecosystemic. or abundant kind of ways of thinking. And so how does this systems approach apply to designing resilient food and health systems that may also be a good parallel for other systems that we've discussed?
Yeah, first of all, I'm just one of the scientists that has researched into systems nutrition. I didn't coin that term. I could name the person who did. It's a very good friend of mine, Jim Caput. He did.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, let's make sure he gets some credit here. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So Jim is my best friend in science, and I learned a lot from him, and we've been doing a lot of work together. So systems nutrition, again, is a bigger thing than precision nutrition, I would say, because systems nutrition acknowledges the fact that nutrition occurs in the context of lifestyle, right? So where you are, what you do, what you like, what you don't like, your exposome to what you're exposed to, and all these things. And we have been pretty bad at quantifying this, right? I mean, we had a very single lens onto nutrition by just trying to measure or even ask people what they eat, and that's it. But not where they eat it, when, and, you know, in which environment, and what else they do. I mean, for example, calories in, calories out. This also depends, of course, on physical activity. That's a very simple example. Cognitive activities and all these things. So now we have these wearables that allow us to measure certain body parameters in a non-invasive way, which is very good. And then it comes eventually to citizen science, so that you know where people live and, you know, what is the infrastructure there? Do they have access to food? If yes, what? Quality, you know, affordability and all these things. So that is about systems nutrition. You quantify not only the consumer, but also his or her environment. And that is a very important factor. And this also highlights the fact that any systems approach requires so many disciplines. And I would argue that we even have to rethink this from an educational perspective, because we are still, everybody talks about multidisciplinary research, which is fine. But in essence, we are still in many ways siloed.
Yes.
I mean, for example, I'm now 61, and I can remember my chemistry studies. It was very siloed. At the time, biology wasn't considered by some of these chemistry professors as a real science because it was more descriptive. You know, what an arrogance. So that has changed. And then biochemistry, biophysics, you know, these are old terms coming to play. And now we talk systems nutrition, which with nutrition is probably one of the naturally most interdisciplinary research fields that you can work on, because it requires almost everything. Maybe not astronomic. I mean, maybe not astronomic sciences, but it requires a lot of different disciplines to comprehend what nutrition actually is. And it's only one lifestyle factor.
Yeah, no doubt. We're finding that. And really that's one of the core focus areas of this series, right? It's the convergence, right? The deep domains are driving kind of rich discovery and development, but also we're finding just really explosive and fascinating innovation at the collision spaces, right? The convergence of these disciplines and domains. So it is important that we have both the translational, but also the deep domain discovery continue, and just have an iterative conversation between kind of those layers, so that we can continue to discover the unexpected, if you will. Would love to, you mentioned this earlier, and I'd love to kind of revisit this through mass spectrometry and omics. You can now track nutrients along digestion and absorption into metabolism, providing what you call a lens into molecular nutrition. So in these closed loop life support systems where every molecule matters, how can these molecular monitoring capabilities revolutionize resource efficiency and health, sustainable health, if you will?
Yeah, I would say you probably can't afford to have a high-end mass spectrometer in the spaceship because it's so big. And it's very, very expensive. Maybe not compared to a space budget, but it's still, it's $1 million an instrument. So it's not cheap and it's big. So, but what you can do is, I mean, these mass spectrometers are basically discovery machines, right? They are not necessarily the machines that you would put in hospitals or medical cabinets or even at home. But what they do is, you know, they basically can measure pretty much everything that's out there in terms of biomolecules and then statistics and precision analytics and smart interpretation allow you then to filter out what really matters. So you can imagine that for certain ethnicities or for certain professions or for certain consumer ages or whatever, some biomarkers matter more than others, right? So we may share some biomarker panel that matters to both our health, but certainly you have a few personal markers that are more important to you than for me and vice versa. So when you have done this discovery, you can then translate or transpose these biomarkers that matter to be measured by smaller devices that are portable. And they just focus on these, whatever, 15 or 50 analytes, and that's it. And that's a lot easier. Once you know what you measure and you can focus on them, multiplex measuring is much easier than measuring everything.
Sure.
So this is how I would use this research to develop basically monitoring tools that focus on what matters.
Yeah, makes sense. Absolutely makes sense. I'd like to, if we could now, talk about your AI platform. So we've touched on this before. Your AI platform can simultaneously screen bioactives for stress resilience, cognitive health, gut health, metabolic health, muscle performance, and longevity, creating what you call an efficacy matrix. So for sustainable health systems, where, and effectively also for space missions, where crew performance across these domains is mission critical, how do we need to think about this multidimensional screening approach to optimize both nutrition and performance countermeasures?
Yeah, again, I think this also goes maybe along two axes. First of all, imagine you sit on a gold mine, but you don't know how to get to the nuggets, right? You know it's in that mountain, but you really have a hard time to get there. So this platform that NemaLife has built, or the sources, the gold mines that Green Biopeptides have identified, now we get access to this because we simply can screen the options in a much faster and more efficient way. You cannot just test everything to full scale because it just takes too long and it's just too expensive. So we test this in a multiplex fashion in a miniaturized organism and have these phenotypic readouts that are proxies for cognitive health, metabolic health, mobility, stress resilience. Remember, it's a worm after all, right? It's a worm. So it's a very simple system. It's proxies.
Right.
And then you can dramatically reduce the number of candidates. Also think about de-risking, right? It's not only finding the goodies, it's also excluding the bad ones, right? So which you do not want to follow up. If your worm turns red instead of green, then you know this is not a good thing to use, right?
Yep.
So it's also about de-risking. And that's what NemaLife and to some other extent also Green Biopeptides do. So you basically zoom into very rapidly into very meaningful, smaller reservoir of very good candidates. So that's a key aspect. And then it is about doing combinations, right? So health is not about single molecules. That is the pharmacological and the drug approach, which is fair enough, of course. And we will always, what a gift to have these drugs that can cure diseases. But nutrition is about multiple individually subtle effects that together in a concert have a bigger effect and typically over time. Okay. That is totally different from drugs, where you take something and it immediately has a big effect. It should have. Now think about combinations. So we have said there's such an enormous reservoir of possible biomolecules, it's already difficult to find them and to associate them to the right benefits. Now, combining this, oh my God, I mean, then mathematics really go through the roof, right? Because there's so many options. So that is the key thing about those platforms, that you can also test combinations of knowns. So you know the individual compounds, but you don't know what they do together. Maybe there's synergy, maybe there's antagonism, maybe they cancel each other out. We don't know. So the innovation could be in finding new ingredients or new combinations of knowns, or some are known and some are not known. That is all made possible. And I think the power of these platforms, be it bioactive peptides, like Green Biopeptides does it, or, you know, this in vivo leverage platform. And NemaLife is basically compound agnostic. They can test anything that is bioactive. You all of a sudden have access to finding the best combinations, and health is a combination of many, many dimensions.
No doubt. In the innovation world, we like to refer to that as structured serendipity, to the extent that these systems can help us structure those serendipitous discoveries a little bit more quickly and with greater precision, all the better. Actually, to that point, if we maybe shift from discovery to implementation, you've emphasized that in nutrition and in food sustainability, we know quite a few things, we just don't do it. So really, we've seen this in many places. So this implementation gap exists really in every complex system. So from your experience bridging academic research, corporate R&D, government policy, what systemic barriers prevent us from applying known solutions, beneficial pathways, and how do we more systemically overcome those barriers?
Yeah, that is, of course, the $1 million question. And I have a few philosophical and then maybe a few more practical answers to this. It's actually true. I mean, in terms of nutrition and sustainability, we know already quite a number of things we should do and we don't do it. And I think one of the main reasons lies in the nature of the human beings, because humans don't like change or challenge. We don't like that. We prefer business as usual because that means stability. Okay. So that's number one. And then if you think about the complexity and the scale of these problems, think about energy, right? You mentioned this in the beginning. I think energy and food are the two big sustainability issues, right? We have to generate and consume it more sustainably. And we know this would mean less fossils, more renewables. This would mean probably less animal protein, more plant protein, these kind of things. And still we don't do it. So I think this requires an enormous degree of consensus and collaboration around the globe, essentially, right? So, and that is, now we talk politics, then it becomes really difficult, especially in today's times. Mm-hmm. Where even, I think, honestly, even acknowledged achievements of the Enlightenment and some facts, what I would call facts of history, geography, and science, are being challenged. Everything is a matter of opinion these days, which as a scientist is a big issue. So that makes it very difficult to convene on an action plan if you already disagree on the basics. And we should agree at least on the basics. Another big challenge is, like we alluded to earlier, fragmentation of disciplines. We tend to nichify, if I may say so, science to come up with more exotic specialties. Sometimes when I watch somebody professor for something and then I read this for what? And I said, what is this? You know, this is so specific. This is so small.
Esoteric. So
We branch out into these mini disciplines, and sometimes we really lack the bigger picture. And so there is a bit of an educational issue. And I think these are the three things. Human nature, to implement into politics is a big deal. Education. And I essentially believe that after all, we have to come up with healthy, sustainable, but also attractive and affordable solutions. Because we can preach until the cows come home, and we need policies. Policies are needed to know this is the big direction.
Yes.
But let's face it, we have been teaching people do this and don't do that. And with limited success, right? Because people essentially like to do what they like to do. So we better come up with something that is adoptable and attractive and also affordable. Especially for nutrition, if there was the healthiest yogurt on earth, if it tastes flat and doesn't look attractive and costs $5, you would not buy it, period. So that is a simple truth.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's knitting together, to your point, the system's beneficial pathways, right, across the systems of society, industry, and policy, and making sure that we have systems of information and incentive to reinforce those beneficial pathways. It requires a fair amount of kind of complex systems design, right, and orchestration. Those are principles that we are really consistently pressure testing in our series here with experts like you. Really, just to double click into that, Martin, if we could, your work demonstrates how biotechnology convergence, really genomics, AI, bioinformatics, miniaturization, robotics, just to name a few, can accelerate innovation from concept to solution. So really, whether it's for space exploration or for the preservation of resilient systems here on Earth, where do those development cycles, which in some cases can be decades long, how can similar convergent approaches dramatically compress innovation timelines while maintaining safety, reliability, and encouraging adoption, if you will? Maybe if we can kind of double click into that for our listeners, that might be very helpful.
Yeah, maybe also maybe a couple of answers to this. First of all, if you take genomics, AI, bioinformatics, miniaturization, robotics, and all it takes, then you can have the bits and pieces to build a mini system of the big world, right? So you can build a little system that is maybe close to the reality of what's out there, but you can control it and it's of limited size. That is already a big advantage. And anything that we can simulate in the system, which is either built in the lab or even in the computer, right? I mean, we have a lot of in silico systems now that simulate certain real life systems, and you can tweak the system and see how does it react. And that can tell you something about how the real system may react if I change this and that. For example, climate models and these kind of things. Extremely complex, totally open systems. But we do a lot with these modeling approaches.
Yep.
And secondly, and then we come back to AI, these systems are, of course, if you want to comprehensively understand them, of course, this means complexity, lots of data, the high connectivity. We come back to the same theme. So AI can help you to interpret the behavior, right? So you basically kick the system and then there are a few reactions. And so, yeah, well, what does that mean, right? What does it tell us about resilience or stability or whatever? So I think in these two ways, it's clear that if we want to preserve complex precious systems, we need to miniaturize them and simulate somehow in small scale how they behave in order to draw consequences for the large scale action.
Mm-hmm. And then revise that thinking and those assumptions as you begin to deploy across a broader scale complex system. And really, just finally, for our audience who are constantly designing complex mission systems or complex dynamic systems, what are some of the key insights from your work on natural bioactive discovery and systems nutrition that our listeners should immediately consider incorporating into their thinking about resilient ecosystem design, whether that's for Earth or for space or for both? What are some of the key lessons or kind of methodologies that you might suggest that our listeners who are designing within complex dynamic systems consider integrating into their approaches?
Yeah, first of all, maybe brute force, high throughput, and large scale is not everything, right? So we have enormous technological possibilities, and we are often seduced by the scale and by the speed. And if something is big and fast, it already looks very attractive. So it's not everything. I think we should very clearly define upfront a benefit that we want to achieve and then inform the design of whatever we do experimentally or in the computer towards that benefit, right? So design first and benefit up front is a, I think it's more a way of thinking. It's not even a way of working. It's more a way of thinking. And whatever we produce in terms of knowledge systems. So you probably have a, you know, in astronomy and in space research, you have an enormous knowledge base of behavior of whatever spaceships or cosmic behavior or whatever. Whatever goes in there must be high quality data. That is very clear. It's a very simple statement, garbage in, garbage out. So we need to feed it with high quality data. And then I often realize that people are still very good at producing databases, but not knowledge bases. So we are very good in putting data somewhere, and then it turns into a cemetery, right? I mean, you don't know where the bodies are buried. You can't find anything anymore. So okay, it's always important to immediately think, and we have the tools today, not only where do I put it and how do I organize it and how can I ask the system? I want the system to give me answers, right? And that is, of course, now with AI brought to a totally different dimensions. And then, yeah, maybe that is, again, the bit more philosophical answer, which I like to repeat here, that humans are not champions in anything, but we can do everything. And I think we should never forget that. So it always will take human intelligence and validation and, you know, and also often a good common sense to put value to something, because a technology as such has no value. It matters what you do with it. The development of the technology is very valuable because it increases the knowledge of humanity. That is fine. But eventually what counts is what do you do with the technology? And that is up to us. So no one, you cannot outsource the job of doing something meaningful and ethically acceptable to any system. We have to decide this for ourselves. So AI should serve us and not vice versa. And I think we should AI to use it for all these things where the human brain is not the best for. And that is highly specialized, large scale, complexity related, fast learning, rapid design kind of, and even a lot of routine things we should do. For example, why should we not drive around in AI-controlled cars? People say, oh, this is not safe enough. I mean, come on. It would probably much safer than us driving around.
So wait, follow me on the road. I don't know. Yeah.
What?
Have you followed me on the highway? I think
there's... No, no.
For sure. No, you're right.
So, yeah, these are a few thoughts I have. So maybe you can sense that I'm, despite all these enormous challenges, I think humanity has never disposed of so many possibilities as before. We just have to use it smartly and responsibly.
No doubt. And in all of the, if you kind of sift through all of the hype related to AI in the headlines these days, all right, there's doom and there's great optimism, but I think you've rightly noted that ultimately these tools are here to help us elevate the human experience, right? That is the
100%
the ultimate purpose and perhaps our ultimate purpose, right? How can we learn what we need to learn from biology, from natural systems, from technological
100%.
Systems in order to establish better systems design to elevate the human experience?
Yeah, and we should die, and we should embrace all these possibilities, right?
Yes.
I'm mentioning this because especially in Europe at least, I noticed some mindset that if you stay out of something, it may be better. You just don't touch it. I think that's nonsense. I mean, I think you not using a technology is never a good idea. So you always have to understand how it works. You should master it, and then you should use it smartly and responsibly. But not using it is never an option. I mean, I don't want to go into this now because we're running out of time, but same with social media. It spreads a lot of noise and a lot of myth and a lot of is dangerous, but it's also a gift And, you know, we just have to use it smartly and intelligently. Staying out of it is no solution, because then it's used by the others that make not so good things with it.
Exactly. It doesn't just go away if you ignore it.
It doesn't go away. You leave the play field to those that may maybe not do so many good things with it. So we should rather actively use it and responsibly use it.
Exactly. Just be the intelligent kind of systems design, the beneficial systems design is more important than ever. We do live in a world that is much more interconnected, and change and innovation travels faster than it ever has before. And so these systems of interconnectivity necessitate thoughtful design, active participation, to your point. And really, we can't just sit this one out. We have to actively participate in the thoughtful, beneficial design of resilient systems and the elevation of the human experience. So, Mark, you've given us so much to think about. I'm so grateful that you've joined us today. I'm grateful for the work that you're leading. And I know you've shared so much that our listeners will be able to kind of take away and apply to their day-to-day. So thank you for that. And for our listeners, thank you so much for joining us again today. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation, certainly as much as we have. Please do check out this season's episodes as we continue examining the convergent technologies and approaches that will shape our ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast, and you can always learn more at shoshimworks.com. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much, Diane, and thanks, everybody, for listening and tuning in. It was my pleasure.